John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for not, oh no, my phone's just sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is tie is this, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imenc.org, for Wednesday, August 17, 2011. Palestinian man dies of wounds sustained last night, and settlers torch farmlands near Nablus. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian pedestrian died of wounds overnight when an Israeli border police jeep hit him in an East Jerusalem suburb. The victim, identified as Amin Debash, 38, was hit Tuesday night by an Israeli police vehicle near the Israeli settlement of Har Huma. Police Chief Shai Hashimi told media that the man was killed by accident in a badly lit area. He added that an investigation has been opened in the accident. The Palestinian newspaper Al-Quds said an ambulance rushed to the scene, but Debash died almost immediately. Debash's family accused the Israeli border police of deliberately killing him. In other news, a Palestinian woman from Ramallah was sentenced to 20-year imprisonment after being indicted of stabbing an Israeli soldier at the Qalandia military checkpoint on the northern entrance of Jerusalem in 2008. Sumud Karaja, 23, from Safa village near Ramallah, was kidnapped 2 days after the incident in which she was accused of stabbing the soldier. The soldier sustained moderate wounds to his abdomen. According to the Palestinian Prisoner Society, the court will not take into account the 3 years Karaja has already spent in custody. The center quoted the woman's brother saying that the military judge has demanded that she, quote, ask for the mercy of the court, end quote, to reduce her sentence, but she refused, saying she did not recognize the authority of the court and considered the trial illegitimate. The general attorney of the Palestinian Authority decided on Wednesday to take off air a Palestinian satire show for its strong criticism of Palestinian Authority leaders and figures. The show is called Watan Ala Watar and is broadcasted in the Palestine TV of the Palestinian Authority. The Attorney General said the law allows him to stop the broadcast of the show if it contradicts the norms and the culture and utilizes, quote, dirty language, end quote, especially against people who are well respected among the Palestinian people. On his part, the chair of the Palestine TV and radio, Yasser Abed Rabbo said the show will stop. However, this will not be the end. Abed Rabbo warned against allowing such decisions to pass, as it will set a precedent that negatively affects democracy and freedom of expression. Abed Rabbo is a member of the Executive Committee of the Palestinian Liberation Organization and a former Minister of Information. A group of armed extremist Israeli settlers torched on Tuesday evening dozens of acres of farmlands near the former Homish settlement north of Nablus City in the northern part of the West Bank. Ghassan Douglas, a Palestinian official in charge of settlements file in the northern part of the West Bank, stated that the settlers set ablaze all trees planted around the evacuated settlement and that the fire consumed hundreds of almond trees and evergreens. He added that trees belonged to local Palestinian residents and that the attack was carried out just as the residents were preparing to break their fast as the Muslims are marking the holy month of Ramadan. That's all for today. You've been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center. For more updates, please visit our website, www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you from Occupied Bethlehem by Hassan Katsis and me, George Fushmal.
Afghanistan, yesterday, NATO reporting the death of a soldier of unspecified nationality from a non-combat related injury in an undisclosed location in eastern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, yesterday, NATO is reporting the death of another soldier of unspecified nationality from another non-combat related injury in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Is this yet another GI suicide? Afghanistan, today, four mercenaries from a private security company were killed in a firefight with Taliban insurgents in central Ghazni province, said Dalat Khan, the head of the Watan Wisp private security company where they work. Baghdad, Iraq, today. A security source reported that a rare clash took place between Iraqi army and police elements in East Baghdad's Beirut Square that caused the blocking of roads leading to the square, but causing no casualties, giving no further details. Baghdad, Iraq, today. Three civilians were wounded when a bomb went off near a checkpoint in central Baghdad's Ahmadiyya district. Baghdad, Iraq, last night. An Iraqi civilian was killed and two others were wounded in a bombing west of Baghdad. El Anbar province, Iraq, yesterday. Six policemen were wounded in the explosion of two magnetic or sticky bombs planted under police cars in the city of Rawa in West Iraq's Anbar province on Tuesday, according to an Anbar police source reporting to Aswan Al Iraq news agency. Mr. Barack Obama, do you really think 8 years of war in Iraq has changed anything? Do you really think even more will stabilize Iraq or Afghanistan? Now is the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops home today.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTradio@hushmail.com.
On September 24, 2010, FBI agents raided the homes of 23 leftist activists in Chicago and Minneapolis as part of a long-running terrorism investigation. Those arrested all refused to testify before a federal grand jury in Chicago, asserting they only engaged in peaceful protests and have long ties with key labor unions and community organizations. According to news reports, federal agents are attempting to link those arrested with activities that provided material support for Colombian and Palestinian groups labeled as terrorists by the U.S. government. The investigation dates back to the protests at the 2008 Republican National Convention. Since then, the FBI has investigated activists for their participation in fact-finding trips to Colombia and the Palestinian territories. Chicago lawyer Michael Deutsch, who is defending the 23 activists, claims they are public, nonviolent activists with long distinguished careers in public service, including teachers, union organizers, as anti-war and community leaders. The activists and their supporters, including labor unions, have formed the Committee to Stop FBI Repression, which has urged the U.S. Department of Justice to drop the case. Civil liberties defenders point to a recent report by the Department of Justice Inspector General blasting the FBI for monitoring domestic advocacy groups ranging from Greenpeace to People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA, in anti-terrorism investigations. Before Hurricane Katrina flooded New Orleans in 2005, Charity Hospital was a robust urban public medical center that served the city's poor African American population and trained medical students from Tulane and Louisiana State University, or LSU. 6 years after Katrina, Charity Hospital sits damaged and vacant. Charity's owner, LSU, has used recovery funds to finance a long-sought $1.2 billion medical complex far removed from Charity's poor indigent population. The new hospital complex has not yet started construction, and critics warn of shaky finances. According to The Nation magazine, Charity Hospital could easily have been repaired, since it didn't suffer extensive damage from the 2005 hurricane. An outside consultant found Charity could have been converted into a state-of-the-art teaching hospital for half of the cost of LSU's new hospital complex. To build its new hospital, LSU took control of 37 acres in the racially mixed mid-city neighborhood and cleared the site by bulldozing affordable working-class housing and small neighborhood businesses. At the moment, LSU is $300 million short of raising the funds needed to build the new $1.2 billion complex.
DJ Munch, check the city, this is movement music.
Have you heard the news?
Walmart's coming.
Georgia Avenue, uptown, ain't that something?
Something.
Small businesses, shop owners, hearts pumping, cause they know their livelihoods is about to take a thumping.
Thumping.
See, you can't compete with a superstore who's an importer of slave labors. Craftsmanship, low price to flip to undercut the market, hand over fist.
Walmart
is infamous for the way they behave. Low wage pay, treat the workers like slaves. Employees who try to unionize, soon find themselves in unemployment lines. The way they treat women needs improving. 1.6 million sisters are suing them for being paid less than the male equivalent. On these issues and more, we can't afford to be ignorant.
Keep DC Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists stop to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
This is the Funkinest Journalist with your three Walmart commandments. Step one, move in and crush competition by underselling. Step two, pay workers nothing and block unionization. Step three, take all that money, put it into the Walton Family Foundation, and turn that into political influence to protect yourself and make even more.
Walmart, it's not a good fit for Chocolate City. Let me holla black at you with the skinny. Important that you clearly understand and remember DC doesn't work with the right wing agenda. The Walton families are big contributors to bigoted representatives and senators. Trent Lott, sinister, Strom Thurmond, similar, Confederate, state loving George Bush ministers. Oversee your plantation mentality, results in black and brown casualties. Statehood opposition for the district has been supported by Walmart's mischief. The D.C. Voting Rights Act was defeated, assisted via Walmart PACs, and now they wanna come here to see their money stack. Stay up on the facts. Chocolate City, don't relax and fight back.
Keep D.C. Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me.
They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists stop to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split.
Walmart Free is an emerging activist group of D.C. residents stepping up to challenge the corporate big box invasion of Chocolate City. Walmart has plans to establish 4 stores in D.C. by 2012. Walmarts in D.C. will threaten small businesses, cause loss of more jobs than it will bring to the community, and lower the wage standards for all workers. To find out more and get involved, visit walmartfreedc.org.
On the 5th of August, several hundred protesters representing unions, Walmart employees who would prefer a union to the current low wages, and D.C. residents blocked 8th Street Northwest in front of D.C.'s lobbying headquarters. Here's why one speaker said Walmart would be a bad idea for D.C. under their current business practices.
They are, in fact, confused about what our issue is with Walmart. In fact, while I was waiting for my brothers and sisters from Johns of Justice, Massachusetts, to show up, because I have been here earlier in the day for meetings, I had a brother come up to me and said, look, man, why are they upset with Walmart? We need Walmart. It's just like, brother, let me explain to you what this is all about. Because I'm clear that you're not reading the papers, you're not watching the news, all you're hearing is the hype. Let me explain to you. Do you know what they do to women? Do you have any idea where their clothing comes from? And do you know how they treat those workers, where that clothing comes from, in Vietnam and Southeast Asia and other places? Do you have any idea how workers are treated at their stores, anywhere? There's no way that Walmart pays you enough to sustain a family. There's no way that Walmart pays you enough to give you health benefits. There's no way that Walmart allows you, particularly if you're black, brown, and female, to give you an opportunity for advancement, for growth, so that you can continue to build this, whatever this thing called the American dream is supposed to be, or certainly was in my parents' lifetime, because I ain't seen it yet. And all of us recognize that, you know, hey, they're in business to make money. It's called capitalism. That's what, you know, everybody's okay with capitalism except for us, right? But, you know, but the truth is, with the way Walmart treats workers, the way Walmart treats communities, it's not just the workers that go down, communities go down when Walmart comes to town. Okay? Businesses that have been in communities for years and years and years cease to exist once Walmart comes to town.
You heard that? We really want to have Georgia Avenue and 3 other communities in D.C. cease to exist so we can have Walmart instead? You may be wondering about why Verizon workers had to walk out on strike. You may be wondering why you can't get your cable TV fixed. You may be wondering why your internet is down and why you can't get your phone fixed. But the reason is that corporate management at Verizon wants to turn back the clock on over 50 years of union negotiations and return to the age of non-union sweatshop pay and no benefits. Here's what one of the striking workers on a picket line on the 15th of August had to say about what Verizon is doing and why. Okay, so what's going on with Verizon CEO making $22 million a year while they're negotiating bad faith?
Well, they're claiming that the company's in the death spiral financially, but in the last year, the top 5 executives got $285 million in bonus money.
$285 million in bonus money, and they want to cut health care for 45,000 employees.
Health care is not the only issue. They want to take away the last 50 years of collective bargaining achievements. They want to cut everything from us. They want the employees to give back $1 billion to the company, and we're saying, no, that's just not fair.
What about the $250 million they're taking in bonuses?
Well, they don't want to include that. They don't even want to talk about it. They come to the table, threw their demands on the table, and walked away, and essentially tell us, take it or leave it. The company is in a financial death spiral, and we're just not going to pay you guys. And it's just the whole fairness of the issue. I mean, we have...
So they say take it or leave it, and you left it.
And we went on strike because, I mean, these fat cat executives have earned their bonuses on the fruits of our labor. We're the ones that maintain the network. We're the ones that build the network.
Yeah. And if they go belly up, maybe you can buy it outright at auction and own the network.
I guarantee you, someone would buy these facilities in a Chinese second. In a Chinese second, and then they will have the benefit of having the most highly trained workforce in the world on communication issues. So we approved our worth. We're showing it now. when they got these replacement workers trying to do out jobs and every customer is suffering because of it.
It's not like it's a problem with the company's values. As I recall, this is a first-class network.
Absolutely. The best one in the country. So, and Fios is the best. In this region, Fios has performed better in marketing than any other part of the country. And we know that it's a falsehood. If the company is claiming $10 billion in assets, how can they come to the bargaining table and tell us there's not enough money to pay us?
Here's an interview with someone on the picket lines at 935 V Street here in Washington, D.C. against Verizon.
So what's going on today with the Verizon strike outside 935 V Street?
Today is just business as usual. You know, we're going to keep on striking until we get what we need to on our contract.
Any progress at the negotiating table?
I've heard they were there until 12:30 last night. Now they seem to have the lawyers involved, so hopefully we'll get something done pretty soon.
Don't these guys care that if they go with replacement workers, there'll be people who don't know anything about the network, which will mean bad service and years of losing customers?
They don't care about that right now. What they care about is they're saving, you know, millions of dollars in salaries per day.
What good does that do them if they don't make any revenue because nobody wants their lousy service?
Well, it's not going to do them any good, but you can't tell them that right now.
That sounds like they're concerned only with the next quarter and not with the next 10 years.
Well, the company is concerned with the bottom line.
That is the bottom line. It's staying in business over the long haul.
And we understand every company is in business to make money, but it's how you treat your people, and your people are making you the money.
Trader Joe's. Just to get a penny more a pound for tomatoes, they're paid next to nothing unless they get this contract. They've been successful with Burger King and with a number of other major buyers of tomatoes. And it's Trader Joe's turn to learn not to exploit their workers.
When President George H.W. Bush nominated conservative appeals court judge Clarence Thomas to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1991, controversy followed. Allegations of sexual harassment made by Anita Hill, a former Thomas employee at the Department of Education, made for high drama during televised Senate hearings and placed the nomination in doubt. But in the end, Thomas was confirmed and took his seat on the Supreme Court. Now, a gathering storm of questions related to Justice Thomas' ethical conduct has prompted media scrutiny and calls in Congress for an investigation. Since becoming an associate justice, Clarence Thomas has cultivated relationships with rich and powerful individuals who at times have been associated with cases that have come before the high court. But time and again, despite the appearance of conflicts of interest, Justice Thomas has refused to recuse himself from sitting in judgment on these cases. One of Thomas' friends, real estate entrepreneur Harlan Crow, has contributed funds to a library and museum project dedicated to Thomas in Georgia, while also showering the justice and his wife with expensive gifts, including giving startup funds for Thomas' wife Ginny's tea party group, Liberty Central. Earlier this year, Representative Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, proposed a bill that would end the Supreme Court's immunity to federal ethics laws, which apply to all other federal judges. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Drew Courtney, Director of Communications with the group People for the American Way. He talks about the growing controversy over conservative Justice Clarence Thomas' ethical standards.
You know, the concerns are really that there's been a broad pattern of ethically dubious behavior that we've gotten from Justice Thomas. And there's some around disclosure, some around acceptance of gifts, some around whether or not he's filled out the disclosure forms. And in some ways, the disclosure questions are the most questionable because those verge on what could be criminal behavior, and we really need answers from him. You know, on one hand, that one item that's been recently highlighted by the New York Times in a very extensively, thoroughly reported piece is his relationship with a billionaire investor named Harlan Crow, who has, through either his own personal connections or through organizations he's been on the board with, given Thomas a tremendous amount of gifts. So, for instance, Thomas accepted a bust of Lincoln from the American Enterprise Institute, on which on whose board Harlan Crow serves, worth $15,000. He accepted a $19,000 Bible owned by Frederick Douglass. He's been on Harlan Crow's yacht. He's been hosted at his estates in California, in Texas, in the Adirondacks. And Crow even donated $500,000 to Justice Thomas's wife's Tea Party group when she was starting it up. So all of this money, which had not been, in many cases, not been previously disclosed at all, is a really uncomfortable situation for anybody who believes that in the court of law you should be able to go in and be heard, whether you're rich or poor, equally. What we've seen is that organizations on whose board Harlan Crow serves have had a great track record with Justice Thomas before the court. So he's on the board of the American Enterprise Institute. The American Enterprise Institute has filed brief in three cases, and what do you know? Justice Thomas agreed with them in all three. On the Center for Community Integrity, they filed eight briefs before the court. And in that case, Justice Thomas has agreed with all eight. Now, it's unclear exactly in each case, is there a quid pro quo? We don't know. But we need answers from Justice Thomas about why he's accepted these things, what is the extent of his relationship, and why isn't he recusing himself from these questionable cases.
What's the response of Justice Thomas to these allegations of his crossing the line on ethics?
Well, they have been very typical for Justice Thomas, and that is, so far they have been essentially silence, at least since the last round of allegations came out. Justice Thomas very famously this February made it 5 years without having asked a question in any oral argument case before the Supreme Court. And so far that's basically what we've gotten from him in response to that. We say he's totally entitled not to ask questions if that's the way he sees fit. But at this point, he really does need to answer them, and that's what we're pushing for more than anything else. In the past, he's said about other allegations, these are liberal attempts to discredit the court, to smear me personally. But when you look at the facts, that doesn't hold up. We haven't gotten any answers. We haven't gotten any explanations, and we really need them.
When it comes to not filing financial disclosure forms, Drew, what can be done to hold Justice Thomas to account? What standards does he have to abide by? None?
Well, the first thing we need is we need more information. And so people need to keep the pressure on as far as asking for information. But the step that I think would make the most difference is that Congressman Chris Murphy has introduced legislation that would extend the Judicial Code of Ethics up to the Supreme Court. That's very, very important, because that would make it very clear why justices that were sitting on cases and why they weren't, whether they were recusing themselves in cases where there were instances in which they had an interest or somebody who gave them money had an interest before the court. And I think that's fundamentally what we have to do. There's a move to have hearings in the House. Of course, it's controlled right now by Republicans, so we can't be optimistic about those moving forward. There's a possibility of hearings in the Senate. And I think there's more digging to be done, and there's more digging that is being done to find out exactly what has gone on so far, especially with I think, in my opinion, these flights. And Thomas has got to answer these questions.
Drew Courtney, what about other groups of attorneys, associations of attorneys like the American Bar Association? Have they weighed in on this issue of Supreme Court ethics, and specifically Justice Thomas and the appearance of impropriety here?
You know, I can't speak to what every other organization has done. I can, you know, speak for a limited set of organizations that I either work for or am intimately familiar with. I do think one thing that's important to note is that there was a letter that was circulated among the legal community that went to Congress basically saying in support of Chris Murphy's legislation, which was signed on by well over 100 law professors around the country, mostly legal ethicists and specialists, who said, this is a serious enough problem that it has got to be addressed right now. And then there have been a lot of other organizations that have taken various tacks, from asking whether or not that there be a Justice Department investigation of whether Thomas and Scalia should have recused themselves from the Citizens United decision, to pushing for more robust hearings in both houses of Congress, to simply trying to make sure that this stays in the headlines and that news organizations are doing their job and continuing to push this. There's been great reporting so far, and we need more of it.
That was Drew Courtney, Director of Communications with the group People for the American Way. Find more information about the controversy surrounding Justice Clarence Thomas by visiting our website at btlonline.org.
Here is an update on the tree sit that has stopped blasting at the Beetree Mountaintop Removal Coal Mine in West Virginia. Out of the two original tree sitters, one of them, Bex Collins, had to come down at the two-week mark, but the other tree sitter, Catherine Ann, is determined to stay. She is 80 feet up, out of reach of bucket trucks and other such equipment. She has now been blocking that mountaintop removal mine from operating for nearly a month. Meanwhile, over the weekend, hundreds of people protested outside Arch Coal's headquarters in St. Louis, Missouri, also demanding an end to mountaintop removal coal mining. Catherine Ann could turn out to be another Julia Butterfly, the woman who sat in a redwood for 18 months to shut down an old-growth logging site in California. Legally, the mine cannot blast because Catherine Ann's tree is in the 500-foot safety zone. An 18-month shutdown of production could financially cripple the mine, hopefully forcing Alpha to shut it down for good and save Coal River Mountain.
Throughout world history, there are countless examples of how an activated and engaged group of citizens have banded together to successfully effect political and social change. Today, across the Middle East and North Africa, autocratic governments and monarchies are being challenged as never before by large numbers of people who have taken to the streets and risked their lives to demand change. Tens of thousands of people in Spain and Greece have risen up to resist the harsh economic austerity measures demanded of them by the European Union and the continent's largest banks. Yet here in America, despite high unemployment, a record number of mortgage foreclosures, and a government which refuses to prosecute Wall Street and bank executives responsible for crashing the economy, it is difficult to find organized expressions of public anger. During this economic crisis, the worst since the Great Depression, Americans by and large appear apathetic or resigned to playing the role of mere spectators in an era witnessing a steep decline in the standard of living for millions. There are, however, exceptions to widespread indifference in the U.S. Take, for example, the massive protests in Madison, Wisconsin, where earlier this year, tens of thousands of pro-union activists organized weeks of rallies, a takeover of the Capitol building, and recall elections to oppose anti-labor legislation. Bruce Levine is a clinical psychologist whose new book is titled Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populists, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling the Corporate Elite. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Levine about the factors he believes contribute to the political passivity and fatalism of many Americans and the strategies that can help people regain confidence and empower them to challenge an unjust status quo.
Actually, when I first heard the term liberation theology, I thought, geez, there should be also a liberation psychology in my profession, because I'm a clinical psychologist. And, you know, routinely my profession is increasingly, and Eric Fromm, the great democratic socialist psychoanalyst, predicted this, and he was more right than he thought he would be, that we become just more one more part of the problem in the sense of helping people adapt and adjust regardless of how dehumanizing a society has become. So the psychologists, psychiatrists, psychoanalysts, we become really tools to just maintain a status quo. And so therefore I thought, boy, there needs to be something equivalent to liberation theology, a kind of liberation psychology. And I thought I had invented this term, Scott, but actually other people had also thought the same thing. And the person who really deserves the most credit for popularizing this term is a guy named Ignacio Martin Barrow. And he was an El Salvadoran social psychologist who was also a Jesuit priest, by the way. And sadly, 1989, he was assassinated by a U.S.-trained El Salvadoran death squad. And Martin Barrow, he got a lot of his ideas about liberation psychology from a lot of what was going on in Central America, South America, Africa. People like Paulo Freire, who wrote The Psychology of the Oppressed. Lots of people around the world, not so much social scientists in America, are hip to the idea that when people become externally oppressed for too long, they develop a kind of internal oppression, a kind of fatalism, a kind of defeatism, or what Bob Marley, who's sort of the poet laureate of oppressed people around the world, what he called mental slavery. And so, of course, he sang about emancipating ourselves from mental slavery. And that's a huge thing, I think, that what I'm trying to introduce and get up stand-up is that we need to start understanding this stuff for America, because I know this is humiliating for a lot of Americans to accept this, but we, too, now have been kind of moved into this kind of a fatalism, this defeatism, this kind of mental slavery. And it's hard for Americans because our tyrants have not been these kind of Mubarak, these kind of Pinochet kind of characters. It's been something much more impersonal, this kind of corporatocracy that I talk about.
Bruce, in your book, you lay out how you believe a democracy like ours here in the United States uses various methods in order to transform a population into a passive and often the case cynical citizens, unwilling to participate, not wanting to participate in a system, thereby leaving it to the powerful actors, the lobbyists, the corporations to really have their way with our government. Tell us about the various methods that you believe are used in the process of making a people passive, cynical, and decide not to participate.
Well, there are classic techniques in psychology, and I mean, you don't need a PhD for this. It's kind of common sense stuff. I should say my profession has a way sort of burying basic common sense one generation, and then we uncover it with fancy experiments the next generation. And in the late 1960s, early 1970s, there were a series of learned helplessness experiments that basically what they showed, which is common sense for most people, that when you put an animal in a situation where there's nothing they can do to control, to stop the pain, that you put them in another task, even when they do have a chance to reduce the pain, say move out of a box where they're being electroshocked, they don't even try to escape. And so there's many kind of parts of our culture and society where you see that kind of learned helplessness. So for example, our national elections, certainly our presidential elections, yes, there are differences between these Democrats and Republicans, but basically on the big issues of senseless wars and corporate control, you vote for a Democrat, you're going to get senseless wars and corporate control. You're going to, certainly Republicans, my God, we get two wars and Obama's maintained them. You go ahead and you try to vote for a third party like a Green Party. Well, the way our national elections are set up, a third party has no chance of winning. Money controls these elections. And then, or if you stay home and you don't vote at all, well, you still get Republican or Democrat and you get corporate control and senseless wars. So lots of other institutions in American life play out this learned helplessness, but there are other psychological principles too that I go through, get up, stand up, like the abuse syndrome, and I talk about how we are sort of subject to this kind of corporatocracy abuse or sort of battered people syndrome.
We only have a minute or so left, but why don't you talk briefly about some of the groups that are organizing out there now that you think provide a good blueprint for what other progressive and populist folks who want to get organized and challenge injustices, what they can take away from these groups?
There are basically two kind of strategies of democratic movements. One is to kind of just withdraw and create your own alternative economy, your own kind of self-reliance. So the workers' co-ops and your producer co-ops. The other kind of thing is, because sometimes you can't pull that off, sometimes it's just impossible, and so the other way that you create a democratic movement is you withdraw cooperation. You create disruptions for authorities, and you force them to negotiate. And so those are your underground railroad, your busing boycotts, and your great labor strikes. Those were that's what's done there. And a good example, one example that's going on today with not very many people, small groups of people in a Boston organization called City Life, dealing with people who are losing their homes, foreclosure, recognize that banks hate bad publicity. They just hate it. And so they've organized blockades and vigils in front of banks, gotten all kinds of media publicity for that, and embarrassed these banks, shamed them because they didn't want to deal with the stock price repercussions, into negotiating with them, giving them fairer loan rates, sometimes even reducing the principal. And so there's been some effective ways of dealing with the corporate elite out there. If you understand what they care about, which is money, and you understand what kind of power you really have, and you actually use wise tactics and wise strategies.
That was Bruce Levine, a clinical psychologist and author whose new book is titled Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populists, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling the Corporate Elite. For more information on Levine's inspirational writing, visit our website at btlonline.org.